from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer. Gay rights activist Cleve Jones cut his teeth in politics with San Francisco supervisor Harvey Milk. And after Milk's assassination, Jones became a leader in his own right. He helped mobilize the gay and lesbian community and government officials in the earliest days of the AIDS epidemic, and later started the Names Project to honor those who died with very personal quilt panels. Jones has a new memoir out. It's titled When We Rise, My Life in the Movement. And Cleve Jones joins us for the hour. We'll get started with Forum right after this. And welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, and today for Mina Kim, who's out sick. Well, the past few years have seen the gay rights movement rack up one victory after another on same-sex marriage, gays in the military, parental rights, banning so-called conversion therapy in California and other states. So many victories that young people coming out now could easily take for granted many of the rights that they have. But of course, those rights came after decades of struggle, discrimination, hate crimes, anti-gay ballot measures, and more. And my guest this hour helped mobilize the gay and lesbian community in San Francisco and elsewhere in those early years before those rights were won. Cleve Jones has written about it in his new memoir. It's titled When We Rise, My Life in the Movement. He joins us now. Hi there.
Hi.
Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
The very first sentence of your book reads, "The movement saved my life." What did you mean by that?
Well, it's absolutely true. I wouldn't be alive if it wasn't for the movement. When I was a kid back in Phoenix, in the early 1970s, I was despondent and was contemplating suicide. I was actually hoarding pills that I was stealing from my parents' medicine cabinet because I didn't want to be gay. You know, it was just that scary back then. And I know there's still young people who feel that way. So, but then I read about gay liberation in the Life magazine year in review issue 1971, and it just changed my life. In a matter of minutes, I learned that I wasn't the only one that felt this way. I learned there was a community, that there was, in fact, a movement. And there were also a number of photographs of really attractive young men with long hair with their fists in the air fighting the police, and that got me quite excited.
And you had very long hair, too. I see the pictures
yes,
in the book.
Yeah.
So what were your coping strategies as a kid?
I stayed stoned for a lot of it, you know, and hid. I was subjected to quite a bit of physical violence and a lot, you know, pretty much constant verbal abuse. My grades were suffering. I wasn't doing well in school at all because really I was afraid to go to class. And I just am so grateful that there was a movement. And for young people growing up today, I think many of us who are older tend to assume that these kinds of issues and pressures have gone away. And they have been mitigated to some extent. But I still encounter young people on a regular basis who've told me that they themselves have contemplated suicide.
Outside of the Bay Area or?
Oh, in the Bay Area. I spoke with a young man who grew up in Berkeley and went to Berkeley High School. And he's in his early 20s, and he said that when he was 15, 16 years old, he was thinking about suicide. But, you know, that's not the only time the movement saved my life. It also saved my life many decades later when I was dying of AIDS and very close to death. And the movement, represented by ACT UP, of course, you know, stormed the FDA and the NIH and changed the way they were running the clinical trials and got something called expanded access so that I was able to get on medications before they were approved. That would not have happened without the movement, and I would not be here without the movement. And obviously, there's a lot of credit goes to the researchers and folks that developed the medications, but the funding and the pressure to make that happen came from the movement.
And the fact that you were in the movement also enabled you in part to get into those early trials, right?
Absolutely. You know, I had the advantages of being a white male in our society with, you know, middle-class social skills, but also the connections that had come to me through the activism.
You write in the book that your mom, I think, was a dancer and your dad was a clinical psychology professor. Mm-hmm. Reading that, I thought, oh, well, then they must have been pretty supportive of you being gay. I mean, that's sort of the profile, right? Not so.
No, one would think. Both my parents were liberals, opposed the war in Vietnam, supported Dr. King.
And Quaker.
And Quaker. But my father was a clinical psychologist who was very much a Freudian. And his reaction was horrible. But I suspected that it would be because I had looked in his textbooks when I was finally, you know, putting it all together around 12, 13, 14 years old. I'm trying to figure out what all these words mean that people are calling me. And when I looked it up, you know, it was pretty horrifying to read about things like electroconvulsive shock treatment and aversion therapy and even lobotomies. So I did not let them find out until I was 18 so that they would not have the power to do that to
me.
Had
you left Arizona at that point?
Then I got the heck out of Phoenix.
Yeah. You know, you're talking a moment ago about young kids who still today are suicidal. I mean, back then, it was hard to know where to find another gay person. There was, of course, no internet. There weren't a lot of gay organizations. There were, you know, here and there, there were some. What, explain for people who might not understand, why would a young person today, with all those resources, all the social media ways to connect with the community, why would somebody today still feel suicidal if they thought they were gay or lesbian?
Well, that's a very good question. And part of it is that even though those resources are there, oftentimes the young person remains oblivious to them. So if you're in high school, you're not necessarily being presented with that information. And also the bottom line is they're terrified that their friends will reject them or that their families will reject them. And they are well aware of the hatred that is still out there. And while social media has certainly opened up avenues for finding out where the resources are, it also exposes them to the really vitriolic hate and kind of, you know, crazy
cyberbullying.
Yeah, exactly. So the cyberbullying is a huge issue, and it's very sad. But we're making progress. And what I really want the young people to know today is that all the progress that they've been able to take for granted hangs in the balance right now. And I absolutely believe that everything that we have achieved in a rather quite short
relatively
span
fast
of time, you know, within my lifetime, I've seen us go from criminal status deemed a mental illness to enjoying, you know, almost full equality under the law. But I think
big exceptions, job discrimination.
Yes.
You can still be fired in
yes.
many parts of the country for being gay or lesbian
yeah.
or trans. Cleve, you came to California. You came to California. I think L.A. maybe you were down in L.A. and you were in the Bay Area. I remember mm-hmm. in the book you say you hitchhiked on mm-hmm. 101 from Palo Alto up to San Francisco. What was it, the movement that brought you here? Because it was still very much in the early years.
Oh, absolutely. I began before I left Phoenix. I was able to get hold of the Advocate magazine. Well, it was a newspaper then. And I started learning more and more about San Francisco. Also, I'd met Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon. I was raised Quaker, and I was at a Quaker gathering the summer of 1972. And Del and Phyllis, the founders of the Daughters of Belitas, the first lesbian organization, were there. And I was just completely inspired by them and amazed by them, and they lived here. I also had two friends, Gary Miller and Ron Bentley, who worked with Jim Foster at the Society for Individual Rights and the Council on Religion and the Homosexual. But it wasn't just that. I loved the architecture here. You know, to come from Phoenix, which was built during the Eisenhower administration, and looks at, you know, to come up here and see the architecture, the density of the neighborhoods, the pastel colors, the incredible diversity, where you could cross the street and the language would change and the food would change and the music would change. I also loved the rock and roll that was coming out of San Francisco then. So I was in love with the city before I ever saw her.
And you get hooked up with Harvey Milk. Tell us how you met him and what kind of a, you know, what light did that turn on for you?
Well, I wish I remembered when I first met him. I don't remember. But I didn't take him seriously. When I first met Harvey Milk, he still had his ponytail, and I thought he was kind of old to be a hippie. He was very funny, but he was just really sort of one of those characters that every city has in every neighborhood. There's, you know, one, who's that guy or who's that woman? You know, what is... And, you know, he was a character and he was quite funny and sweet and flirtatious. But he started cultivating me. And during the years leading up to his election, in every encounter I had with him, he would push me. He pushed me to run for the Democratic County Central Committee. I was traveling in Spain and happened to stumble upon the first gay demonstration in Spanish history, which turned into a riot. And I wrote an account of that, and he got it published while I was still in Europe. So he was really one of the first people to, I think, see value in me as I was, as opposed to my parents, who saw value in me if I would change. And he was extremely kind to me.
And he pushed you to get a college degree.
Yeah, he bribed me, really, because he knew how fidgety I am and I couldn't sit in class. So he got me. I started as a film student at City College, and I made a Super 8 movie. I'm sure some of your listeners will remember Super 8 cameras. And I made a short film, and I showed it to Harvey, and he took me aside where no one could hear and said, "Cleve, you have no talent at all."
Pick another career.
Yeah, change your major quick.
and so did he actively? It sounds like he actively recruited you, so to speak, for politics, for his
yes.
for his political life and camp. What
yes,
became and, his campaigns,
and also even more important than his own campaigns was that we had a good year and a half warning that that John Briggs from Fullerton was going to try to replicate what Anita Bryant had done in Dade County. So I was working on building a foundation to fight back against that was Proposition 6 back then. And he sent me out. It was his idea for me to organize the college students. So I spent
And just, we should just say it would have prevented yes, openly gay teachers.
It would have prohibited any LGBT, what we now call LGBT people, or our allies from working in any capacity in any school district in the state. It was a horrendous measure and would have, you know, really been disastrous. But he sent me out on the road finding these little fledgling gay and lesbian student organizations and pulling together a coalition. And those young people ended up being a big part of the troops that we sent out door to door walking precincts.
And the Briggs Initiative was sort of overwhelmingly defeated, I think 58% no.
Yes, it was an astonishing victory. And I don't think we saw another statewide election victory until just a few years ago. That's how long it took. And this was during an era when we didn't have the big fancy black tie dinners and the multi-million-dollar media buys, that's for sure.
And that was also the time of Anita Bryant and rolling back of local gay rights
yes.
ordinances. Yeah. Talking with Cleve Jones, a longtime gay rights leader, and his new book is called When We Rise, My Life in the Movement. Tell us a little bit more about your working for Harvey Milk. I mean, he was not in office very long. He ran once for the state assembly and lost to Art Agnos, who you and, full disclosure, I later went to work for. What did you learn from that first campaign about political organizing?
I learned so much from Harvey, but I think the most important thing for me was that, you know, I'd been beaten up a few too many times. So when I got to San Francisco, I was pretty heterophobic, if you will. I mean, I would have quite happily, I would have built a wall, you know, around the Castro to keep everybody else out. And to see Harvey, who was older than me, a Jewish guy from New York City who'd come to this city and fallen in love with it, to watch him campaign was really remarkable because he was just fearless and he would go up to anybody. He'd go up to a hard hat, he'd go up to a cop, he'd go up to a rich lady from Nob Hill, he'd go up to a homeless person or a hippie kid, a hustler on the street, and he'd say, "Hi, I'm Harvey Milk." And he'd shake your hand and he'd make eye contact and he would find common ground. He would find something to build a conversation on, and it was very respectful. And it also showed me just such a genuine love of our city and such genuine affection for all different kinds of people. And, you know, we see this with the politicians all the time. They make the significant eye contact and they tell you they feel your pain and it's all BS. But with Harvey, it wasn't. He just took such joy in these encounters. And that's why he won. That's how he inspired people. And also that another thing that really mattered to me then was that I'm not a single issue person, and neither was he. And people forget about that now. He was for unions. He fought for seniors. He cared about kids. He was concerned about the environment. He built the very first coalition we had with organized labor, with the Coors beer boycott, when we allied ourselves with the Teamsters. I mean, if you would have imagined any union that would be the first union to be in coalition with the LGBT people, I don't think one would have predicted the Teamsters. And, you know, I work today for Unite Here, the hotel workers union. And I think, you know, my involvement with that union directly connected to my history with Harvey Milk.
When he finally gets elected to the Board of Supervisors, that's 1977, he had also had a political evolution. I mean, he came from Long Island, I think. He was a Republican.
Yes.
He was
in the
military.
Yep.
He was a kind of a businessman sort of candidate initially. And
Living in the closet.
Living in the closet. To what extent did you witness that evolution of him, and what did that entail?
Well, I didn't meet him, of course, until after he'd fallen in love with Scott Smith and grown his hair long. He'd been involved with the original production of Hair, the musical. And so, you know, he came to the revolution a bit late in life but embraced it fully. So when I met him, he was sort of in full hippie mode with the long hair and the jeans and being part of that scene. And then in 1975, I started hitchhiking, and I went to Europe and the Middle East, and I came back a couple of times, but most of 75, 76, and 77, I was traveling. But every time I came back, I saw a little bit of a change in him. And then there was the transformation, which is actually recreated in the Gus Van Sant film Milk, where he gets the secondhand suit and he cuts his hair and he comes out from behind the curtain and it's a new incarnation of Harvey.
And it worked.
It did work. And
he needed that to sort of broaden his appeal.
Yeah.
Or to be taken more seriously.
To be taken more seriously. I took him more seriously and I already loved him.
Yeah. So he, of course, didn't serve long before he was assassinated. Tell us about that era, that time that he was in office. You worked for him along with Dick Pabich, who died of AIDS years ago, and others. Ann Cronenberg, I believe, was also there. He was elected the same time Dan White, who later was convicted of assassinating Mayor Moscone and Harvey Milk. But they were sort of friendly, weren't they, at least initially?
Initially, and this was, of course, the first election under district elections. So the board had gone from pretty much all white, all male, relatively conservative, to a board that more fully looked like the people who live here. Ella Hill Hutch was elected, an African-American woman, Gordon Lau, a Chinese-American, Carol Ruth Silver, a single mom, Harvey Milk, a gay guy, and Dan White. And Harvey was more patient with Dan than I was. I didn't like him. I found him creepy and petulant, and he just struck me as being childish and also one of these people who doesn't seem quite comfortable in their own skin. So he always made me nervous. But Harvey did reach out to him. Dianne Feinstein also reached out to him and tried to, assist him and guide him a little bit. But that man was deeply troubled, clearly. Yeah.
The day of the assassinations, I think you were not at City Hall at the time, but you went to City Hall. Just recount what you found when you were there and, you know, what went through your mind? What did you think what was going to happen next?
Well, I actually got there early that morning because Dick Pabich and Ann Cronenberg were Harvey's paid assistants, and Annie was up in Seattle visiting her parents. Dick was getting ready to start his political consulting firm with Jim Rivaldo, and Harvey had begun talking with me about the possibility that I would take over Dick's job as long as I could maintain, you know, at least a couple classes. So I was, you know, very eager to show Harvey how useful I could be. So I got there that morning early, and I annoyed him because I'd left a file in my apartment on Castro Street that he needed. And he was kind of abrupt and sent me back to get it. Though on the way out, he saw that he'd hurt my feelings. And he said, I'm sorry, you know, come back this afternoon, take lunch. And so I went back to get the file, and there was a picket line. The union I now work for was picketing the patio cafe on Castro Street, and I joined the picketers, and somebody in the 24 bus yelled out the window that they shot the mayor. And I remember just thinking, what on earth? Who would shoot Mayor Moscone? And this was just after the People's Temple massacre in Guyana. So there was all sorts of wild and crazy rumors everywhere. And so I grabbed a taxi and got down to the Van Ness side of City Hall and went in, and I saw the cops over by the mayor's office. And I ran up to the board chambers. This was before the earthquake, so the building has since been reconfigured. But there used to be a private hallway parallel to the public hallway. There was a passageway. I had a key. I went in, and I came around the corner and saw his feet sticking out of Dan White's office. And I knew it was him because he only had one pair of dress shoes, a pair of secondhand wingtips that he bought at the thrift store. And, you know, I was only 24. I'd never seen a dead person before. It was horrifying. It was really horrifying. And then I think the most awful memory is of playing the tape that he'd made. You know, he
foresaw his assassination or his death.
He predicted that he would be murdered, and he left a tape for us to play and to hear his voice talking about this while his body's out in the hall was just... it was bad, and I just kept thinking, it's over, it's over, this is the end of it. It was the end of my, you know, I didn't really have a relationship with my actual father at that particular time in my life, and losing Harvey was a very personal blow, but he was also one of our leaders, and it was just awful.
We're going to coming up to a break, but of course, Dan White got a very light sentence, 5 years manslaughter, and the White Knight riots came. Just briefly, Cleve, we do have to take a break, but it was a violent reaction to what had happened and anger at the police. Dan White had been very close to the police. In the end, was that a breakthrough of sorts, like, say, the Stonewall riots in New York City?
Oh, I don't think anyone could debate that question. And I was raised Quaker. I abhor violence. But there are times when it happens. And when people say, oh, violence never accomplishes anything, I think, I'm sorry, you haven't read history. And the violence of the White Knight riots moved us forward, like it or not.
All right. Cleve Jones will be here for the rest of the hour. His new book is called When We Rise, My Life in the Movement. If you'd like to call and join our conversation, give us a call at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also email your comments to forum@kqed.org or leave a comment on our Facebook page. Or you can tweet us. We're at KQED Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer here today for Mina Kim. Lots more to come. Stay with us. And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here. My guest this hour is Cleve Jones, longtime LGBT activist. He's got a new book called When We Rise, My Life in the Movement. If you'd like to join us with your own memories, recollections of that era, a long era, Cleve, and it's still going on. We're about to have a new chapter. Give us a call, 866-733-6786, or you can email us. It's forum@kqed.org. I want to fast forward a little bit. You went to work in the legislature, as I mentioned, for Art Agnos and Speaker Leah McCarthy, and you were there at the very, very beginning of the AIDS epidemic. And ultimately, you yourself got very sick and were lucky enough to get into these trials. What was it like? So many people died, and you walked around the Castro at that time, and you saw people like walking cadavers who weren't even that old; they were in their 30s and 40s. And you were getting to that point. What was it like to basically be anticipating your death, and then suddenly find a new lease on life?
Well, it was a brutal time, and by 19, I read about it in the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report from the Centers for Disease Control, which was one of the things I subscribed to because Speaker McCarthy and then Speaker Brown had both had me working with the Health Committee, the Assembly Health Committee. So I saw that first notification in June of 81, and then the New York Times did a story about a month later, I believe, and I was alarmed by those very first ones. And then I met Dr. Marcus Conant, dermatologist up at UCSF, and he took me into the hospital there and introduced me to a young man named Simon who died that week. So I saw very, very quickly and suddenly, you know, just this was bad. That was June of 1981, and by the fall of 1985, almost everyone I knew was dead or dying or home caring for someone who was dying. And it's a really harsh disease, and those of us who were caring for people, it was really, really tough. So I was very frightened. I never gave up, though. I never did give up. I kept fighting.
In terms of your own health, you mean?
Yeah, I think, you know, one's attitude does matter. And I was determined to fight till the bitter end. But I left the city. I moved up to the Russian River. I wanted to be somewhere peaceful. And I also was afraid of getting evicted. So I bought a little tiny house up there to have that security of knowing that I could not be thrown out, an issue even more relevant today. And I got into one of those very first trials. Marcus Conant got me in. And within a couple of weeks, I started getting my strength back. And I remember going into the Guerneville Safeway and running into a friend named Jeff, who was also seeing Dr. Conant and gotten into the same trial. And he said, I guess we're not going to die. And I said, well, I guess not. And then he said, but we'll never be happy again. And I remember thinking, no, of course not. How could we ever be happy again? And, you know, I'm 62 and I'm healthy and I'm very happy. And I think it's good to remember that one can endure really horrendous challenges, and especially since this last election, that's been on my mind a lot, that, you know, we can survive and we can move forward.
All right. Let's go to the phones now, and our first guest is Art Agnos.
Oh, what a surprise.
Hi, Art.
Hey, guys. How you doing? This is a banner day for me, and I think it's a first for KQED because I am listening to two great former staffers, one the interviewer and the other being interviewed on a top-flight radio station. It's a thrill for me, and I'm very proud of both of you. As a matter of fact, I can tell the audience that I have your performance reviews in front of me.
We have yours too, Art.
Yeah, we got yours, Art.
And both of you were outstanding, not only in the issues that you're discussing now and the great history that Cleve is talking about, but in so many other areas as well where you performed a great service for the public. But I want to ask both of you, and really Cleve as well, I'm sure, a fundamental question that's very applicable to today, and that is this. Could you, Cleve, and you, Scott, come here today, find a place to live and work in the fashion that you have with your storied careers as you did 25, 30 years ago?
I think about that a lot.
Me too.
You know, I got here in 81. Had very little money, had everything I owned put into a Ford Mustang and drove here from Madison, Wisconsin. And, you know, I was able to find a place to crash with two other roommates, $400 mm-hmm. A month, I think it was. And I didn't have a job. I couldn't do that now. I mean, you hear of kids coming here and they're living with four or five roommates out in the Sunset and out in the Richmond. But even that's tough.
Yeah, it's something I think about every day, actually, because this is part of a really much bigger picture, which is the transformation of all of our cities. So places like the Castro, the Gayborhood, if you will, these are going away, and they're going away very, very rapidly. And this is driven mostly by the incredible increase in the cost of housing. It also has to do, of course, with a bit to do with tech and the reality that gay people no longer need to live in these spaces to meet each other. But
tech meaning social media.
Yeah, social media. Yeah. So people have other options to when I was young, if I wanted to meet somebody, I had to go out of the house. And also, to some extent, increased acceptance gives people more options of places to live. But when we lose these areas, we lose the political power that comes along when you're concentrated in specific precincts. We lose the cultural vitality that happens when creative people, artists and choreographers and dancers and filmmakers and poets and activists are living together and working together. And the specialized social services for our most vulnerable, people living with HIV, transgender individuals, seniors, and our kids, who I now feel, many of whom living in the red states, with the increase in the hate crimes that we're seeing, I think there's going to be a lot of young people that are going to want to be getting out of where they're living, and I don't know where they're going to go.
And Art, you came here as a young man as well from Massachusetts, I think. And
absolutely. Same story. And it's one that I know both of you care a great deal about. But we've got to stay with that issue because we want to provide that kind of opportunity for the next generation that's coming.
But absolutely.
Can you really? I mean, that you also have at the same time a lack of affordable housing, and often neighborhoods don't want affordable housing. They don't want to go up. They don't want it to go higher, which is more density. It's how do you fix that?
Well, that's the challenge, and we can have another hour on that. But I don't want to take away from Cleve's great story and all that he can tell the people that I'm sure are waiting in line. But I just want to tell you how proud I am of both of you and what you're doing, and keep on doing it.
All right, Art, you too. Thanks so much. Thanks so much for calling in. And, I recall when Art was in the Assembly, and he brought the Surgeon General out, C. Everett Koop, in 1987, I think, to address a joint session of the legislature to talk about AIDS, because at that time the president, Ronald Reagan, wasn't.
Yeah, no, there was a time when San Francisco had done more than the federal government to fight back against this disease. And, excuse me, I'm so happy at the progress that's been made medically. It's not accessible to everybody that needs it. And right now we have the tools to prevent HIV transmission. And now we need to do a better job of making sure that those tools are available, especially to young people of color.
Let's read some comments we've got from our listeners. Celine tweets, bless you, Cleve Jones. Your voice means so much. We need to hear the stories of history to guide us forward. And a listener comments, a real hero. God bless Cleve Jones and his work.
Thank you.
What are you hearing from people as you sign books and talk? And
well, I tell you.
You're an old guy now.
I'm so old.
We both are.
No, you're still young.
Yeah, right.
Writing this book was difficult, and it was made more difficult by the fact that I lost my parents during the process. mostly, I was just anxious that the writing would be of sufficient quality. I know I have great stories. I've witnessed extraordinary things and been a part of some amazing adventures, but people have responded in a way that I never anticipated, and it turned out in a way that, when I started working on this, it had never crossed my mind that Donald Trump would be president of the United States. But I think that in a sad way, this book is timely because so many people right now are feeling that so much of what we fought for, so much of what we've dreamed for is now possibly going to be swept away in the blink of an eye. And so if nothing else, my book, I think, is a story of survival and endurance and keeping the faith. And I hope that people will read it and be strengthened and inspired.
Let's go to the phones. Ron is on the line in San Francisco. And again, the number to call is 866-733-6786. Ron, welcome.
Hello. Thank you. As a native San Franciscan, a little diverging from calling about Harvey for half a second, I lived in the Haight-Ashbury at 211 Downey Street for $89, me and a group of people, a month. And that was fantastic as the origination of the Summer of Love. Now, coming to Harvey, our group, we had theater business. And I was in partnership with Arthur Meyer, who had many theaters, and director and a producer. And we had met Harvey coming to, I think, a play at our on Broadway had to do with the singer. And that aspect, we got together and we started a restaurant on 19th and Castro called the Castro Cabana. And Harvey would bring his Democrats in there, and, you know, we'd give them free coffee and all that good stuff. And we even had a society party there, which hit the newspapers. But the bottom line to it was we talked with Harvey because Meyer had been involved in the North Beach Street Fair. And in that North Beach Street Fair, he had the idea. So we sat with Harvey talking about a street fair for Castro Street. So then Harvey got a hold of the merchants, one of the merchants' groups on Castro, and we went there. And from there, that evolved. He went downtown, and he made that happen. That man was a doer from day one and probably one of the nicest people, but don't let that fool you. If somebody hurt or was involved in some violence in that neighborhood, he was out there organizing a retaliation for that incident. So Harvey was a man amongst men.
All right. Ron, thanks so much for the call. I wonder, you know, Cleve, what do you think Harvey Milk would make, and it's always a silly question to ask that, but of the sainthood? You know, he's Saint Harvey now, and he, you know, like all of us, he was a flawed guy.
Yes, in every talk I give about Harvey, I always say he was neither a genius nor a saint, and I think it's important for people to know that. Because as we mythologize people, you know, he's been portrayed by Sean Penn, and there's an opera about him, and books and poems, and he was an ordinary guy who lived on above his little shop. He was a terrible businessman. His personal life was often in complete disarray. He suffered all of the humiliations and defeats and challenges that most of us endure in the course of our lifetime. But he was tenacious. He loved his city. He loved his people. And he ended up being a very, very important figure historically. And I think he would love the attention, okay?
Especially the opera.
Yeah, especially the opera. And also having a public elementary school named after him. I think of all of the honors that have been heaped upon him posthumously, I think the one that would touch his heart the most is the Harvey Milk Civil Rights Academy.
And, of course, one of his big messages to young people was come out wherever you are. That was really, in many ways, to this day, what has made the difference is that more people know people who are openly gay and lesbian and trans and bi and all that.
It's absolutely true. And it was at a time when it was very risky for people to come out. It is still risky, but not as frightening as it was back then when there was zero legal protection and even more violence. But that strategy was first put in place in the Prop 6 campaign, and it was the first time in history, I believe, when gay people came out en masse and walked door to door and knocked on their neighbors' doors and said, look, I'm your neighbor. I'm gay. Please don't vote for this. It will hurt me. It will hurt my family. And Harvey just kept telling us, the more they know about us, the less likely they are to vote against us.
Here's some questions from listeners who have emailed us. Pete asks, can Cleve please comment on Randy Schultz, former Chronicle reporter and author, Randy Schultz's belief that the gay movement was responsible for keeping bathhouses open in the face of AIDS? Big issue around 1985.
This is a complicated issue, and it's important to put it in context. Randy was definitely engaged in some advocacy journalism at the time. He was using his platform at the Chronicle to push Dr. Silverman, who was head of the public health department, to close all of the bathhouses. And this was a controversial issue. And I think for those of us—
Why was it so controversial?
For those of us looking back now, it seems like, oh, well, that would be common sense, you know, close down the bathhouses where people are having so much sexual contact. Of course, the location of the sexual contact wasn't really the issue. It was the sexual contact. It was, you know, having unprotected sex. But what made it so alarming to many of us was that we had just recently been decriminalized. So if you're going to start closing the bathhouses because gay men are meeting there and having sexual encounters, well, gay men are meeting in bars. Gay men are meeting in parks. Gay men are meeting in any number of places. So I was really, you know, it was a torturous decision for many of us. And Bill Krause and Randy Schultz and I had, you know, endless conversations about it. But there were a lot of concerns that if we allowed this, then who knew what would happen next? So,
and that's where you were. That's where you came down.
Yes, I was. You know, it's sometimes it's nice when you can know exactly what is the right thing to do. But in that case, I did not know what was the right thing to do. And looking back at it now with everything that's happened since, I still don't. I'm not sure what I would do about that issue. I think I would probably require all of those establishments to be more regulated and have HIV testing on the spot. Another thing that was interesting about it was that we, after the test became available, you know, we were the baths attracted a lot of people who were closeted. And so this and in other cities, these places have become a place for testing and regular checkups and the rest of it. But yeah, it was a difficult time.
Yeah. All right. Let's get another caller in here. Michael in Oakland. Welcome.
Hi. So a moment ago, Cleve raised the fear that the incoming Trump administration was going to roll back the progress we've made on rights for gay folks. I am no fan of Donald Trump. Donald Trump is a horror that I could not imagine coming to the United States, let alone the world. But on this specific issue, I don't understand where the fear is coming from, because he said at his convention speech, we are going to protect the rights of our LGBTQ community. He had Peter
Although the context for that was against terrorism. That was what he was talking about. But go ahead.
Well, he said that in the same
It was after section. The shooting in the nightclub in Florida. Yeah, but go
right,
ahead. I'm sorry.
He was still saying we're going to protect our LGBT. I mean, he could have just lied to that issue. He could have just said we're going to fight terrorism and not mention the fact that it was an attack against gay people. He had Peter Thiel come up on stage, and Peter Thiel said, I'm proud to be gay. I'm proud to be Republican. I'm proud to be a supporter of Donald Trump. He had this famous scene where he posed on a stage with a bunch of blue-collar working-class supporters with a huge rainbow LGBTQ flag. Like, it seems to me we have a lot of reasons to be afraid of Donald Trump. I don't understand why on this specific issue there is all this fear, aside from, you know, his ex-vice president or something.
The fear is the people he's surrounding himself with and the outright bigots, including his vice president, who have made a career of gay bashing, essentially. All of his cabinet appointees or nominees are vociferously anti-gay and anti-science. And there's also the reality that he has uncorked the bottle that has allowed the normalization of hate speech and hate crimes. And we're seeing a dramatic uptick in these incidents. So you, if you wish, may take his promises to heart. I don't believe a thing that comes out of his mouth, but I look at who he's appointing and their, you know, quite well-documented records of attacking LGBT people, and I am very alarmed. I also am very concerned about the Supreme Court appointees. So I think that, you know, the likelihood is that we're going to be dealing with the damage of this election for the rest of my life, and that many of the young people who may be listening are going to be dealing with it for their entire lives. This is a terrible tragedy in the history of our country.
And I'm wondering, you know, so many people, Cleve, and Michael, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Feel that, you know, one of the narratives out of this election is that the rise of identity politics, Black Lives Matter, the transgender bathroom issue in North Carolina, Colin Kaepernick taking a knee during the national anthem, immigration, you know, that led to gave rise to the support that Trump got, because a lot of working class whites, for example, said, well, what's in the Democratic platform for me? What do you think of that?
I have my own issues with the extreme vocabulary of identity politics lately, and I find it quite frustrating for a different set of reasons. I want us to be unified, but I don't really think that's what happened. I think what happened is that the working class people all across this country of all races have not recovered from the recession, have not recovered from the housing crash. I spent a lot of time in Ohio and Michigan and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin. This is, you know, I have family there. And, you know, there's about half of the country is still not doing well. And I think that this is a repudiation of neoliberalism more than a reaction to identity politics. neoliberalism is increasing the gap between rich and poor. And there is huge frustration out there. And the Democratic Party chose to abandon the unions. You know, I think it's really been the dismantling of the unions that, more than anything, that's paved the way for this to happen. So working class white people who voted twice for Obama voted for Trump. So I'm not going to tar them all with the racism brush. Certainly racism and xenophobia and to some extent misogyny played a role in this campaign, this election. But I think more than anything, this is a repudiation of neoliberalism. And we saw, it's very interesting to me that we saw both party, the establishments of both parties under attack from powerful insurgencies, and the Republican leadership seemingly was defeated and swept away and in their defeat won. And the Democratic leadership was successful in squashing their insurgency, and in their victory lost the country. So that's the way I look at it.
Here's a sort of relevant comment from a listener, Ben, who writes, lately I've heard about fissures in the gay community with race and ethnicity as the fault lines. Have you experienced that yourself? What can the San Francisco community do to remove this barrier to unity? And that's part of what you're doing with the Unite Here Union, right?
Right. So, yes, of course we have those fissures. I mean, LGBT people are born into every color of skin and every faith background and every economic status and every ethnic heritage. So, of course, we reflect the same divisions of the larger society. And, you know, one would hope that as a minority we would be more empathetic with other minorities, but that is not always the case. And so in my union, Unite Here, you know, we represent hospitality workers, and we're black and brown and white, and we're native-born and immigrant, and we're gay and straight, and we all work together, and we don't allow ourselves to be divided. We know that if we're going to take on these big multinational corporations and win victories for working-class people, we need to be united. And I think that the efficacy of that strategy was proved by us in Nevada in this last election, despite the what happened with the rest of the country. Nevada went blue. We elected the first Latina to the United States Senate. That is because of the efforts of Unite Here and our affiliate in Las Vegas.
The culinary workers, yeah. We began earlier talking about Harvey Milk, who was the first openly gay elected official in the country. And since then, of course, there have been many here in San Francisco, Mark Leno, Tom Amiano. We've had two openly gay lesbian speakers of the state assembly. And I'm wondering, how do you think the quality and the political orientation of gay and lesbian candidates and elected officials has changed since the time that Harvey Milk was?
Oh, you're trying to push my buttons, aren't you, Scott? I don't like neoliberals. I don't like pro.
Describe what you mean by that exactly.
Well, I think, you know, this is a democratic state, and so we see that there's these elections up and down the state now where the chambers of commerce are no longer bothering to finance the Republican candidates because they know the so-called moderate, so-called pro-business Democrats will carry their water and do their bidding. And I'm disgusted by it. I think that the Democrats have largely abandoned their base, the working class people of this state and this country. So there are a number of out lesbian and gay elected officials who I do not consider to be part of the movement. I do not consider them to be fighting for working class people.
Could you make the counter argument that that's okay because, after all, you know, they're now gay and lesbian folks are integrated into the political system, and there should be a spectrum of political orientations?
Well, there always is a spectrum of political orientations, and I come from the left, and I'm frustrated by gay and lesbian elected officials who seem to have abandoned the roots of our movement. Our movement was part of a broader movement for peace and for social justice. That is what we believed in the days of gay liberation. That's certainly what Harvey Milk believed in. That's certainly what Harry Britt believed in. That's certainly what Carol Migden believed in. That what our struggle as LGBT people for equality and for justice was a part of a broader movement that was intended to lift all of us up out of poverty, out of racism, out of violence, And I think that's been abandoned by many of these people, and I regret it.
Just about a minute left. You and others of the generation of leaders that you come from sort of handed the baton off to a younger generation of LGBT and other, you know, minority community leaders. So what do you see? What's the frontier look like? What are the issues that the next generation of leaders in the LGBT community especially is going to have to grapple with?
Well, I think the overwhelming priority now is to defend what we've gained in the light of this election. I'm still processing it. I'm going to be at the Jewish Community Center tonight at 7. I'm hoping to have a good conversation with folks about that very issue. Certainly, expanding protections for our young people is at the top of my list because I know our kids are still getting beaten up. I know our kids are still killing themselves. I'm talking about gay kids. I'm talking about trans kids. We need to do that. And we also need to figure out how, as the gayborhoods disappear, which they are, how do we maintain that political power? How do we maintain the cultural vitality? And how do we maintain the vital social services that are so necessary for the most vulnerable members of our community?
All right. Cleve Jones, and as he just said, will be appearing tonight at what time, Cleve? 7:30?
7 o'clock.
7 o'clock at the JCC with KQED's Peter Stein in conversation with him. So thanks so much for being here today and for all your decades of service as well.
Thank you, Scott.
The new book, again, is called When We Rise, My Life in the Movement by Cleve Jones. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineers today are Katie McMurrin and Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from Amanda Font. Our interns are Brandon Yu and Maxine Schofer-Wolf. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our executive producer is Joanne Wallace. For Mina Kim and all of us here at KQED, I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.